to Saffron Art on the occasion of upcoming miniature auction on the 24th and 25th next week. We're very privileged to have Malini Roy, visual arts curator at the British Library, and of the recently concluded Mughal exhibition, which I don't know how many of you got to see, but it was fantastic. She's going to do a brief talk about an introduction to Indian painting, and I'll hand it over to her.
Thank you, Abba. Well, as Abba mentioned, I just finished an exhibition. It ran from November of last year till April 2nd, and it was called Mughal India, Art, Culture, and Empire. And it was an exhibition that focused on the British Library's own collection of Mughal manuscripts and paintings. And so Abba's asked me to give you a brief overview of Indian painting in general. We're not going to just look at Mughal painting, but a good cursory overview of Indian paintings produced between the 16th and the 19th centuries, because it's quite a large topic and very difficult to give an overview, but I will try my best. The first painting on the screen I'll just briefly mention is a painting by an artist called Mansur, and he's a master artist at the Mughal court during the period of Jahangir, who's one of the Mughal emperors who rules between 1605 to 1627. And he's a wonderful artist who produces some of the most beautiful natural history drawings, as well as flowers and birds. And it's a lovely painting in the collection of the Windsor Royal Collection. And I just thought it would be a nice painting to start off with. My intention, as I mentioned, is to provide a cursory overview of the tradition of Indian painting executed between the 15th and the 19th centuries. The paintings that we will look at are often referred to as miniature paintings. However, it is becoming more common for art historians and galleries to use the more general term of Indian painting to refer to these works. To understand the complexities of Indian painting, we begin by looking at a map of the Indian subcontinent, which has disappeared. Well, that's a brief overview, on which the centers of Indian painting are indicated by the red dots. Some of the key sites, as you can see, I've highlighted, this is the region which we refer to as the Punjab Hill paintings, and this is the region of where most of the Mughal paintings are produced, and Rajasthani paintings over here. Historically, the Indian painting tradition was sponsored by beneficent patrons such as emperors, kings, and members of the nobility. These influential men, as well as some women, commissioned lavishly illustrated biographical accounts, devotional texts, interpretations of romantic poetry, portrait studies, as well as scenes depicting court life. In the royal workshops, artists would either work collectively or independently to produce fine illustrations. Today in museums and galleries, such as the paintings that are on the wall here, paintings are framed or hung on the walls, a manner which is accessible to the modern viewer. However, this format is far removed from the original intention. As works of art on paper, these illustrations were intended to be viewed by the patron alone or shared with a privileged audience. Rather than being displayed on the walls, these works were often stored as either single folios or bound in manuscripts, so the viewer had an opportunity to marvel at the intricate details of each work. So here I've got one example showing what a stack of folios would look like. This is a Jain manuscript of the 15th century, and it just shows how they would be stacked up and stored as a stack. Whereas on the next slide, I've got just an example showing just a miniature painting that would feature in an album as well as an illustrated volume. To begin with, I wanted to start at looking at manuscript illustrations of the 15th and the 16th centuries. The tradition of painting in the Indian subcontinent originated in the 12th century, when religious devotees would commission scribes and artists to produce illustrated manuscripts of a devotional text in the Jain and Hindu traditions. The earliest manuscripts were rather unique and were not brimmed with imagery. Rather, select narratives or symbols were pictured, not always correlating to the text. Using rectangular folios in horizontal format, on folios made from palm leaf until the introduction of paper in the 14th century. Passages from the narrative would be inscribed in order, and each folio would be numbered. An early example, a late 15th century Jain manuscript, the Kalpa Sutra, which is featured here, is a canonical work of the Jain religious tradition. This was commissioned by donations from committed devotees. This extremely stylized approach to painting can be identified by its flat composition, pronounced outlines of figures and objects, and exaggerated body types with elongated eyes. And if you can look closely here, you see the flat landscape and everything is very two-dimensional, and there's no suggestion of perspective or recession of space. The dominant color scheme favored the shades of red, blues, and greens, and there is little detail added to the background of the dominant image. Alongside traditional Jain manuscripts, artists also produced narrative illustrations relating to the tales of the three major Hindu deities, Brahma, the creator of the universe, Vishnu, the preserver of the universe, and Shiva, the destroyer. An example of the Balagopala Stuti, the eulogy of the youthful Krishna, a Hindu devotional text. This manuscript and others produced in Gujarat and Rajasthan during the 15th century were influenced by the Jain style we previously saw. Most of the times when you look at Indian paintings that appear in gallery catalogs, auction catalogs, really focus on the later period, starting with the 16th century onwards. And so I really wanted to start the lecture in a bit more detail, looking at Mughal court painting. And specifically, it's these centers of Agra, Delhi, and Lahore where Mughal paintings were produced. The conquest of northern India in 1526 by the Central Asian prince Babur, who ruled from 1526 to 30, incepted the Mughal Empire, a Muslim dynasty that would persevere and rule through the mid-19th century. Having legendary ancestors such as Genghis Khan and Timur, Babur defended Ibrahim Lodi, the Sultan of Delhi, and went to establish the cities of Kabul, Agra, Allahabad, and Delhi as the major strongholds of the empire. Fighting battles against their opponents, including the Afghan and Persian invaders, the Mughal emperors would persevere to keep their position and jurisdiction over the northern region of the subcontinent, as well as expand their interests to western and central India. While the Mughal Empire flourished through the mid-19th century, from the mid-18th century onwards, they ruled only in name, as they lost most of their territories to the Marathas and the British. Babur's immediate successor, Humayun, who passed many years in exile from northern India, living in Iran, is recognized for inviting two of the major important artists from Iran, Mir Sayyid Ali and Abd al-Samad, on his triumphant return to Kabul. Although Humayun died prematurely, falling from the steps of his library, his son Akbar is actually recognized and is the most important of the Mughal rulers to actually form the Mughal artistic studio and give rise to this new tradition of painting. The new style of Mughal art was inherently an eclectic combination of the Iranian Safavid style of painting with inspiration from prevailing indigenous Hindu styles. And so on the screen, I just selected portraits of the three major Mughal rulers who were instrumental in the Mughal painting tradition. We have Akbar, who's the first Mughal, or the third Mughal ruler, his son Jahangir, and lastly Shah Jahan, who builds the Taj Mahal. And these are wonderful paintings from different collections from the British Library where I work, whereas, as well as other institutions such as the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And this one painting in center is quite surprising to look at, because when you look at it, it's completely different from most paintings on most Mughal paintings, because it's actually an allegorical portrait showing Jahangir slaying the image of poverty. And sometimes you find these fantastic scenes showing Jahangir, it's a dreamlike state that a lot of these paintings represent, and his own wish fulfillment. On the next slide, I've got a couple different illustrations showing the range of materials that were being produced at the Mughal court. To begin with, we have a page from the Hamzanama, and this is a wonderful manuscript. I shouldn't say manuscript. There were large paintings on cloth that were painted at the Mughal court during Akbar's time. And there's approximately 1,400 folios that were painted on cloth. They're approximately, 2 feet by a foot wide. So they're quite large paintings, and they were produced over a period of 14 years. So there were quite large projects that were undertaken by members of Akbar's artistic studio. At its peak, there was approximately 100 artists working for the emperor alone. And then other subjects that they were interested in, Akbar commissioned a translation of his grandfather Babur's memoirs, and these were translated from his ancestral language, Chagatai Turki, into Persian for the use of Akbar and the members of his court. And then Akbar commissioned his artist to create an illustrated version of these memoirs. And this is a scene showing Babur from these memoirs hunting. And this is a fantastic scene showing all the different members of the court gathered around, enclosing the animals for the ease of the emperor to slaughter the deer in the center. And lastly, during Akbar's time, one of the other major projects he commissioned translations of Sanskrit epics into Persian. And these were wonderful scenes, and they're abridged versions of texts such as the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and these were translated from Sanskrit into Persian and disseminated at the court. And then I've got two other fun paintings. One, which is the one on the right, left, comes from a manuscript in the British Library's collection, which is a collection of poetical works by a 13th century poet named Nizami. This is filled with wonderful scenes. And on the other side, we have a fanciful compilation of Europeans as imagined by Mughal artists. And these are two different genres that would appear very popular during the Mughal period. They had a passion for Persian classics such as the Shahnameh and poetical works by Hafez, Nizami, and Jami. And these were very influential at the Mughal court, and a lot of these beautiful illustrated manuscripts were produced at that time. But unfortunately, Mughal painting would come to a dramatic end, not a complete end, but it would dramatically decrease in style and artistic output because of the rule of one of the more orthodox rulers, Aurangzeb. And as a result, there was a decline in artistic patronage, and the tradition slowly migrated to provincial towns such as Lucknow, Faizabad, and Murshidabad. But at the same time, beautiful paintings were produced, and they are commissioned not by the ruling, not by the emperors, but the local governors who were living and ruling over Lucknow and Faizabad at that time. It's very difficult to give you an overview of Indian painting because there's so many different centers of Indian painting that where you've got significant artistic output taking place between the 16th and the 19th centuries. And it's really only that you can point out where these different locations are. And central India is a very complex area to look at for Indian painting because a lot of the paintings didn't actually survive because of the control of the Mughals, extending control down southward into the Deccan Plateau. During the course of the 17th century, the independent Muslim courts of the Deccan, in the Deccan Plateau of central India would become enveloped into the Mughal Empire. Expanding their territorial claim southwards, the Mughals would first infiltrate the region of Ahmednagar, appoint one of their high-ranking courtiers as viceroy of the Deccan, who would reside in the city of Aurangabad, and use his base to launch further campaigns and eventually dominate the regions of Bijapur and Golconda by 1686 to 1687. With the settlement of Mughal officers and in the region of Aurangabad, there was a noticeable diffusion of Mughal culture that would become visibly apparent as the local tradition of painting matured. Little is known about the style of painting that flourished in Ahmednagar prior to the arrival of the Mughals, as there are only a handful of paintings that can be accurately dated. In the 16th century, there were three significant rulers who exerted political influence and would have been the most likely candidates to commission paintings. And their names are Hussein Nizam Shah, who rules from 1554 to 65, Murtaza, who rules from 1565 to 88, and Burhan II from 1591 to 95. And one of the problems when you look at a lot of these Deccan paintings produced in Ahmednagar and the surrounding areas of Golconda and Bijapur is that many of these paintings are unsigned. And there's no inscriptions that, in this one there's a really tiny one, a fragment that was later added. But there's not very many inscriptions that give you information about these paintings, either about who the portraits or the sitters of these paintings are, or even the artists who were working on these paintings. And it's only through a lot of historical examination, comparing different paintings, portraits, which have had inscriptions to help you identify the identity of the sitter, that it's really possible to really create a comprehensive overview of this region of painting. One of the most interesting things is that in the Deccan region, they were quite influenced by portraiture. This is a concept that becomes very important in mobile painting, and that comes transmitted to the Deccan court. But similar to the Mughals, they preferred these somber colors and quite very defined outlines for figures, as well as a preference for solid backgrounds painted in gold. And that's very characteristic of these paintings. In the neighboring territory of Bijapur, there was no significant artistic activity or royal patronage of artists until the rule of Ali Adil Shah, who rules in the mid-16th century, and his follower, Ibrahim Adil Shah II. Similar to the case of Ahmednagar, artists were producing illustrated manuscripts on topics such as astronomy, as well as idealized portrayals of princes or sultans. Within the following decades, during the reigns of Muhammad Adil Shah and Ali Adil Shah, as Mughal ideals disseminated into the Bijapuri idiom, artists shifted from their idealized and intimate studies of sultans at leisure and began to show a preference for recognizable portraits of their patrons. One of the wonderful things that pops up during this time as well is that they're quite influenced by the presence of the Dutch who are living in the Deccan at that time, specifically in parts of Golconda. And what they start doing is this style of painting that's made for a European or an export market. And they start preparing these sets of portraits of notable figures, particularly rulers of Golconda and the Deccan areas. But they also include few portraits of some of the Mughal rulers from the period as well, such as Aurangzeb. And this is a compilation that is kept in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. And the album is called the Witsen Album because it's named after the man who compiled the album or who collected it in the 17th century. As compared to Mughal painting and Deccan painting, painting in Rajasthan is very difficult to give you an overview of because there's so many different courts where painting was very dominant, such as Amber, Udaipur, the whole Mewar region, Bundi, Kota, Datia, and Bikaner. And slowly you do have a lot of infiltration from the different courts, but it's quite a very disparate types of styles that appear during the 16th through the 19th centuries. Initially, the style of painting that would appear in the 16th century onwards was rooted in the early painting that I showed you at the beginning from Western India and this Hindu manuscript or Sanskrit manuscript on the life of Krishna. In this region, there were numerous independent principalities where the influence of local rulers would give rise to distinctive new artistic schools. Mewar in southern Rajasthan was the most prolific. In the 16th and 17th centuries, local artists integrated bold colored schemes, architectural backgrounds, and flat compositional styles into their works. Drawing inspiration from Sanskrit epics, Mewar artists produced complete series on the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. The illustrated volumes that I'll show you in a moment. This is one of the early styles of painting that links back to this Hindu manuscript, the Balagopala Stuti. But this is one of the dispersed Bhagavata Purana manuscripts, again on Krishna. And every once in a while, a folio such as this will appear on the market. But unfortunately, what you find over time is that a lot of these original manuscripts are not kept, were never kept as an entire collection. They were dispersed either back in the 16th, 17th centuries. It's very unclear to know the history of how these manuscripts were split up. But this very manuscript is dispersed, and folios have appeared throughout public and private collections for, I don't know, about 50 years, more than 50 years. But it's very interesting to see this. But one of the great Mewar manuscripts, the Ramayana, produced for the ruler Jagat Singh of Mewar, who rules in the mid-17th century, is actually pretty much intact. And there were seven volumes of this manuscript that was produced for the ruler Jagat Singh, and six of the volumes are actually kept at the British Library, and the last volume was split up in India during a later period, and is kept between, a museum in Bombay and a couple private collections and an institute in Jodhpur. And it's very difficult when, you know, you see a complete, you have so many volumes intact and the last volume is split up. And because of this problem, the British Library actually has gone ahead and forged a partnership with the institution in India to create a digital reunification of all the seven volumes. And that way, not only art historians can get a glimpse of the entire manuscript, but so can anyone interested in studying Mewar painting. Aside from paintings looking at the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, there were other important texts that were influencing artists. This is the Gita Govinda, an illustration from the Gita Govinda, and this is again a dispersed manuscript that's in various collections across the world. And Krishna, of course, without fail, is always very popular in Indian painting and always appears. And he's quite influential. And aside from the Gita Govinda, the devotional poetry of Radha and Krishna, there is other topics that influenced Indian artists working in Mewar, as well as the wider Rajasthan, including topics such as Hindi poetry on the classifications of heroes and heroines, as well as scenes on the musical text called Ragamala, and scenes on the different seasons of the year relating to, or called the Baramasa. But more importantly, or more popular, I guess, are the portraits of the different Rajput rulers that appeared during this period. And one of the great things about a lot of these Rajput artists is that they would sign their paintings, or there's an inscription on the reverse of the painting that would give you information of the ruler. And this one is by a very well-known Mewar artist called Choka, and he has a very distinctive style of painting and very exaggerated figures of the Rajput ruler. And there are beautiful scenes that Choka paints, and oftentimes you see these Saluki hounds appearing in the scene along with his wider entourage. And it's very nice when you compare these with Mughal paintings. Oftentimes the Mughal paintings, the entourage, every individual within the entourage would actually be identified by a small inscription. But when it comes to Rajput painting, you know, these are very stylized individuals, and it's very difficult to know who some of these men are. In Bikaner, which is in northern Rajasthan, you have a lot of the paintings are more heavily influenced by the Mughal naturalistic color palette. And this is a Ragamala painting, which relates to what we call the Garland of Musical Melodies. And each of the different melodies has its own iconic or own identifiable iconography. So this very specific Ragini is a forlorn lady walking amongst peacocks. And every time you see a woman and she's holding two strands of pearls in her hands to attract the peacocks, this is this very specific Ragini, a Kakuga Ragini, and painted by a Bikaner artist. And one of the difficult things about looking at Bikaner painting is that it's so very similar to Mughal painting that it's very difficult to be able to tell the difference between a Mughal and a Bikaner painting, because they're very sensitive when they draw the paintings and the facial types. There's actually one of a princess over here, and that's actually a Deccani painting, but it's very similar in style. And when you see so many similar representations of women, it's up to an individual to actually look at all the very details, such as maybe the style of the clothing, the jewelry style, or you know the way a face is represented, to be able to distinguish between a Bikaner work, or Mughal work, or a Deccani painting. And this is one of the scenes devoted to the seasons of the year. And again, Radha and Krishna tend to feature in a lot of these paintings, even though that the poetical work that it represents doesn't specifically mention Radha or Krishna. They're the idealized sense of lovers that appear in a lot of Rajput painting. And this is one of the fantastic scenes showing a tiger in the background. And this is one of the months when it's a very stormy month, and lovers separate and try to be reunited. And usually a lot of these poems refer to, you know, the struggles that the hero and the heroine, you know, they have to fight, walk through, you know, storms to be reunited and face the different, how would I put it, storms and different wars, and I can't really remember what I was about to say, but it's they're quite fun to look at, and to look at all the specific details. In this one, you've got these beautiful elephants mm-hmm. just hidden in the background. But one of the unique things about these paintings is that the way they represent architecture, it's not a typical way one would understand architecture to be drawn today, but this is a very stylized style of the region of Bundi. But we also find that artists in Kota and Bundi are very influenced by animals. And there's these wonderful hunting scenes that appear throughout Bundi and Kota painting. But this one I thought was quite special because it really shows how much attention that the artist has put into drawing this elephant. I mean, little care is given to the different men holding these instruments. Some are laden with fireworks that are blown up to tame this wild elephant. But, you know, every detail is given to drawing the expression of the elephant. In the Punjab Hills, which is the northern part of India, again, we begin to see artistic traditions flourishing. But one of the things about the Punjab Hills, which is very interesting, is that most of the painting styles, a lot of the painting styles are influenced by the Mughal school, by artists working in Delhi and across northern India that flee from the Mughal courts during the mid-18th century when there is the important invasion of Nadir Shah, who comes in from Iran, sacks Delhi, and destroys Delhi and takes the famous peacock throne and all the jewels and the treasury. And so artists begin to come to look at some of these northern territories to look for suitable patrons to commission new paintings. And again, they're influenced by different Sanskrit texts, and this is one called the Devi Mahatmya. And this is a fantastic scene showing Kali fighting the demons of Chanda and Mudra. Ooh, here's one here in blue, and one down here. But it's just the way that she grasps in this version, how she grasps, just plucks one of these horse elephants and is able to just shove it in her mouth. It's quite fantastic. But a lot of these paintings, you'll find the ones that relate to devotional texts or Sanskrit texts, either the text is painted or inscribed on the front of the folio or on the reverse. And that's how you begin to be able to identify where these folios come from and what manuscripts that they relate to. And that's quite important. And the difficult thing about a lot of these texts is that they're often written in a script that is no longer easily readable by most historians today. And they're in these dialects of Takri and other languages that most people don't study today. And that's quite a shame, because for something like this, you would have to go back to one of the key art historians that still reads this language to be able to identify these paintings. And that's in Europe and in the US, but in India, I presume there's more art historians still studying these languages and able to understand
them. What language is that?
This one is, I would have to check. I don't remember off the top of my head, but if anyone knows, they're welcome to let me know. And this is another series. This is a bit earlier. This is from the 1700s period. And this is a region called Kulu, where you have this very distinctive new style of painting appearing. And this is a series called, which we refer to now as art historians, as the Shangri Ramayana, because it relates to a specific ruler. And there's several volumes of this manuscript, but unfortunately, again, it was dispersed, so you only find specific folios that have appeared on the market since the 1950s and onwards. But on the reverse, you usually find the passage of text that relates to the episode that you see in the front, and know exactly which passage this is from. And they're very sweet paintings, and they're very simple in style. They're not like some of the earlier paintings. Well, this is much later, but when you see so much detail given to every single textile as well as tree and foliage in the painting. But, you know, the emphasis on these paintings of the Shangri Ramayana is really the interactions of these main two characters. And when many people think of Indian painting, one of the main artists that come to a lot of people's minds is an artist named Nainsukh. And he's an artist that paints in the region of Gular, which is in the Punjab Hills. And he's got some of the most expressive paintings. And they're really emotional to look at. And although he flourishes during about 1750 onwards, his children, as well as there's a lot of artists who paint in his style. And I found this really lovely scene, again, showing an episode of Radha and Krishna from, again, a Gita Govinda manuscript, which has been dispersed. But they're wonderful scenes, and you begin to see so many different artistic styles when you look at all these paintings, that it's very difficult to tell between a Gular painting and a Mewar painting until you spend quite a bit of time looking at them. And briefly, I wanted to end with looking at just a few examples of company paintings. So what happens after all these different principalities, the Mughal emperors all enter, whose rules come to an end, and what happens when you have a huge British presence across the Indian subcontinent? Well, what happens is a lot of Indian artists begin to look at the British and the Western market as a source of patronage, finance, as well as to acquire these paintings. And they oftentimes were producing paintings showing trades and occupations. And the one on the left is from Tanjore in South India. And it just shows a weaver, there's a spinning wheel right there, with his wife. And we've got in this set, there's I think about 25 or 30 folios showing different couples in different trades and occupations. And that's quite a popular pastime. But the artistic style changes from region to region. And the one on the other side is from Patna, on the right. And this is showing a woman in a shop selling Indian sweets. And this is painted by a notable artist named Sheikh Mohammed Amir of Kerala. Artistic style changes when you go from artist to artist, but a lot of these company paintings were quickly produced for an export market. But some of my favorite ones that were produced in the later period were these natural history drawings. And when the British were in India, they spent quite a bit of time creating scientific studies of the flora and fauna of the region, which Babur, the first Mughal emperor, had also had commissioned. But these were more scientific studies that Indian artists were creating that British scientists and Scottish scientists would take back to England to study the specimens up close. And on the other side is this lovely scaly anteater, or a pangolin, that was produced for Lady Impey. And she was a main a collector. She had a menagerie of animals in her own residence in Calcutta in the 18th century, and she was the wife of the Chief Justice. And she commissioned some local artists, and this one is, I think, Bhavani Das, to produce studies of the animals in her private menagerie. And this one is my favorite because he's actually quite sweet, and I actually thought he was an extinct animal. And when I displayed him in our mobile exhibition, a member of the public came up to me and told me that when he was in Southeast Asia in the 60s, there was actually one of these on their campsite, and he was just a friendly creature on the camp. They saw him every day, and then one day it was served for dinner. So,
okay,
I was sad to hear that.
Maybe he is extinct now.
Yeah, probably is extinct. But she created these lovely scientific studies, and they're quite popular today, but lovely to look at. So I hope you've had a good overview of what Indian painting is and the diverse regional styles of painting, but it's very difficult to follow without spending a lot more time and looking at school by school, because I've only given you a brief overview, but there's so many more schools out there to look at. So,
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.